you. It's a privilege to be here, and I'm going to be describing how a multi-sector approach to agricultural conservation can provide us with a multifunctional landscape. And I'll be talking about some of the organizational tools that can provide us with a forum to have that dialogue, and then some of the tools and models that might help us to structure that particular approach. I think Jerry mentioned earlier the movement of corn up into the Dakotas and certainly down across the area where I grew up through Nebraska and Kansas has displaced a lot of grasslands, and that's created some challenges both for the conservation of biodiversity in those areas as well as for the traditional cattle ranching in those areas, and then also looking at concerns about pollinators and pollination services that are required for agriculture. So those conservation issues are connected to water quality issues, and we start to see the way that corn agriculture is managed throughout the Midwest and rice and other crops down the Mississippi Alluvial Valley, and the concerns that that's raised through the Sparrow model, showing us where nitrogen runoff is creating concerns for Gulf hypoxia down in the Gulf of Mexico. So we see that each of these sectors has connected challenges with water quality, wildlife, energy, agriculture, recreation, and fishery losses. We believe that with the use of conservation practices and strategically designing and configuring those on the landscape as an integrated part of agroecology, we can achieve our goal of having corn and shrimp, and we commonly refer to our segment of the United States. We're working across the Midwest geography as the corn and beans landscape. In the South, I think that translates to the grits and shrimp landscape. So we're hoping to be able to have both. We also recognize that those losses in the conservation not only affect fish and wildlife, but they also affect the ecosystem services that are necessary to boost agricultural production and resilience. And this was mentioned this morning in the symposium on sustainable intensification of agriculture and the relationship, the linkage between all of these sectors. So we do have good agricultural conservation practices, both for water quality concerns as well as for fish and wildlife and for ecosystem services. We've made great strides in identifying ways to promote those practices and to adopt those. Part of the issue remains that each sector tends to prioritize separately. So we see a landscape that's key locations for conservation practices that would affect water quality, key locations for conservation practices that would affect migratory birds and wildlife throughout the central part of the United States. There's an opportunity with U.S. power transmission lines and the conservation practices that could be associated with those. And then finally, the agricultural conservation through NRCS and the Healthy Watersheds Initiative. Each of these has traditionally kind of planned those landscapes separately. We believe that there's an opportunity now for creating a think tank of natural resource researchers and managers that can come together to align those actions, but we need to create that forum for that dialogue, for that conversation, and I know some of those conversations are happening here at this conference as well. So to do that, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has initiated the Landscape Conservation Cooperative concept, and that's divided the continent and actually out into the Pacific and down to the Caribbean into 22 ecological geographic regions that also tend to have similar production, like forestry up in the Great Lakes, the corn and beans agriculture here in the Midwest, the Great Plains states, and other parts of the continent. So the concept is that representatives of each of these fish and wildlife organizations, water management organizations, NRCS, and the NGOs that are associated with natural resources, a representative body of those different organizations comes together twice a year and provides us with guidance and direction to identify some of these massive long-term landscape scale challenges and then identify ways to address those. So this Gulf hypoxia challenge is one of the ones that I'll highlight today in the process that we developed to bring this community, this multi-sector community together to identify what are the shared outcomes that we want across agriculture, water quality, energy, and the environment. How will we know when we get there? How will we measure that? What are the physical and social drivers that are leading to Gulf hypoxia? And how can agricultural conservation practices benefit those sectors? So in 2014, we brought together a group of stakeholders from across the Mississippi Basin to create that conceptual framework. And then through 2015 to try to identify what are those conservation practices that have the give us the opportunity to address each of these sectors, and then where would we position those practices throughout the Mississippi Basin in order to benefit the sectors. And then earlier this spring, we brought people together again to say, now that we have kind of a draft blueprint of where those conservation practices might be located across the Mississippi Basin, what models are available to help us refine that approach. So again, the goal of this initiative is to look at tools for targeting conservation investments. And this is just one example of how the landscape conservation cooperatives are addressing landscape design in multi-sector issues. This is the premier issue across the central part of the United States and the Mississippi Basin. Other landscape conservation cooperatives located in other parts of the country and in the oceanic areas are identifying other topics and issues. So one thing I would really strongly encourage you to do is if you're in another part of the United States or up into Canada, down into Mexico, look up the landscape conservation cooperative that's in your area and feel free to get engaged to identify those issues and help to create some of the landscape scale, address some of the landscape scale challenges. So what were those high-impact practices that potentially have multi-sector benefits? Those are listed on the screen here as kind of an initial list that the stakeholders identified. Many of these are talked about here at this conference: cover crops, drainage water management, buffer strips, wetlands, prescribed fire, grazing, biofuel production, depending upon how it's done, and floodplain restoration. So some examples of those: these landscape conservation cooperatives have pooled funding from across the state and federal agencies and NGOs to support research on some of these multi-sector conservation practices. So one of those is Iowa State University is working on a prairie strips project where they put strips of prairie along the contours within the farm fields to provide some protection from soil erosion, from nutrient loading and runoff, to provide some pollinator and bird habitat and restore the soils in those areas. Another conservation practice that we're working on research is looking at a situation where Smithfield Foods, as an example, is one of the largest hog producers in the world, and they have hog CAFOs across northern Missouri. They have about 2 million hogs at any particular point in time in 9 farms across northern Missouri. And the manure that is generated by these hog farms provides us with an energy opportunity. So they've capped these lagoons and are pulling the methane off of the lagoons, refining it locally with small refineries about the size of this room, and then injecting that into the nation's power pipelines. The problem is that leaves the solid manure behind, and it's not possible to convert that directly to methane, to gas fuel, without combining it with a carbon source. So naturally, they would probably plant a single species like switchgrass or miscanthus and harvest that as a carbon source. This is an example of an opportunity for multi-sector conservation. So instead of just planting a single species, the acreage that's being planted as a carbon source could have a variety of species that would also provide wildlife benefit as well as the water quality benefit, depending upon where it's positioned in the landscape, and provide an energy resource. So this is a great project that is located with Raceline Alternative Energy and Smithfield Foods in northern Missouri. Similarly, I know many of you are familiar with the drainage water management process and the Transforming Drainage organization that's a coalition throughout the Midwest that's looking at drainage water management And this is another practice that has great potential for agriculture, as it can help the farmer to have more management over soil moisture and provide more resilience to the kinds of droughts that Jerry talked about earlier. Depending upon the seasonality of managing these systems, small wetlands, and particularly in soybean fields in the Midwest, can provide habitat for long-distance migrants like this American golden plover. This little bird and a number of other shorebirds have long migrations from South America up to the Arctic, and unfortunately, unlike coming out here from Indianapolis, these little birds didn't have a nonstop flight. So they've got to stop in the Midwest and refuel, and so these wetlands in farm fields that are managed through water control structures can provide some of that habitat. So again, it's a question of how do you design conservation practices, thinking not just about a single sector, what a water quality impact, but also what are the wildlife impacts and what are the energy impacts. So once those conservation practices have been identified, the next question is, where would you implement those? So to address that, we looked at where are the key water quality concerns for Gulf hypoxia, and identified this portion of the Mississippi Basin in light blue based on the USGS Sparrow nutrient loading model. Then we cataloged the fish and wildlife conservation priority areas that are identified by Ducks Unlimited, Audubon, the Forest Service, the Migratory Bird Joint Ventures and others, and as well as the state wildlife action plans and the conservation opportunity areas, laid all of those, stacked them together, and then looked at where is the highest interest in wildlife conservation across the Mississippi Basin. And you see those areas highlighted in red where there are key locations for wildlife conservation of various types based on the plans that have been developed in the conservation community. Similarly, then, we asked the question, well, where are there areas where there are current watershed management projects taking place, which is an indicator of social receptivity and willingness to participate in conservation practices. So we developed or collected a system of all of the different areas that we could identify where there are watershed projects. Again, stacked those together, and in red you see locations where there are concerns about water quality and where there are a number of watershed projects already ongoing. We then looked at where is that alignment of water quality conservation interests, watershed interests, and production systems where there are some pilot areas of high concern for nutrient loading that we could start working on developing these conservation strategies and then identifying where that conservation could take place on areas that are least profitable, agricultural lands, and then marginal soils, essentially, what sites are most conducive to wetland restoration, prairie restoration, or floodplain forestry, and where is there the highest benefit for water quality and for wildlife. So that resulting tool is online. It's developed with over 200 data layers, the state wildlife action plans, the other conservation plans that I showed, a lot of water quality maps, and that is all publicly available for download. And if you're interested in any of those kinds of data layers, go to this system first. It's on the USGS Science Base and database and platform, and you can download any of those by just registering for the site. So then how would we downscale that and use that large multi-sector Mississippi Basin process to guide local conservation action? An example is the Lower Wabash Floodplain Conservation Project, where NRCS, Ducks Unlimited, Nature Conservancy, and others have gotten together to identify local goals for wildlife, water quality, soil health, and connection to nature and adaptation to future changes. They're using these tools to help them to identify which conservation practices would they want to implement and where would they implement them in that area. Another example of how these mapped conservation tools can be used is Decatur County, Indiana, is developing a comprehensive plan revision for guiding where land use would take place within their county. One of the concerns in the county is where to site confined animal feeding operations so that they minimize their impact on water quality and on wildlife or conservation areas. So they use this system. It has a 30-meter layer in it to identify where the grassland opportunities, the forest opportunities, and the wetlands might be in the county, and then they can zone those areas for conservation and shift the siting of the confined animal feeding operations and the land application of manure into areas where there's less sensitivity for water quality and for wildlife conservation. Similarly, the Sycamore Land Trust was looking at where would we identify areas for wetland corridors for land trust conservation acquisition in areas that are marginal cropping areas that have good connections for wildlife and can provide benefits for water quality. The state wildlife action plans are also using this system. And again, the nice thing is that it sets it within the larger context. What are you doing within the state for wildlife, for water quality, and for agriculture? But how does that fit into the whole Mississippi Basin context and those larger landscape long-term goals? But then also using the 30-meter tool to identify where within these locations could you actually do conservation. A similar activity, kind of more at the regional level, is piecing together these kinds of conservation strategies from different regions for a larger area of the Southeast to identify where conservation action could take place in priority zones in that area. So that's kind of what kinds of conservation practices would benefit multiple sectors, and where would you position those to have that maximized targeted benefit across the Mississippi Basin? The next question is, what models are out there, tools that could help to refine this tool? And I'm going to go through fairly quickly a couple of those models. The first, again, is drainage water management and identifying where drainage water should be managed to provide resiliency for farmers for climate change, but also resiliency for wetlands and fish and wildlife purposes. Similarly, in regard to climate change, there's a tool that was developed by the Northeast Climate Science Center that identifies where streams are most vulnerable to climate change and the fish communities within those streams. We're proposing to expand that across the Mississippi River Basin so that climate vulnerability can be a part of this tool as well. The Argonne National Laboratory and Oak Ridge National Laboratories are developing hydrologic models to look at the impact of conservation practices on nutrient loading, and they're also now starting to consider how they would take into account climate change and the impacts on hydrology, on agricultural practices, and on conservation as it relates to the Gulf of Mexico hypoxia issue. There's also a process, a project that would expand that site-based conservation application and looking at planting of prairies as a feedstock for digestion of manure for bioenergy production. And then the question is, if you could site those facilities across the entire landscape throughout the Mississippi Basin for water quality, for wildlife, for energy, where would those locations need to be for the refineries and for the production, co-production of that energy from livestock agriculture? All of these tools and many of these models are available, but they can't really inform conservation decisions unless they're provided through in a platform and in a framework that program managers can access, whether it's a certified crop advisor or a Farm Bill program lead, or the lead for an Environmental Protection Agency watershed management program. They need to have access to these tools and to these models so that it can inform their decisions. So the Nature Conservancy has developed this freshwaternetwork.org centralized platform for decision support, and they're starting to build that out with these tools. And then finally, another process that we're using is looking at how individuals interact with these tools online can tell us a lot about social interest and social receptivity to different conservation practices. So an online system that gives you a menu of conservation actions and kind of by watching, observing how people select those tools and what impacts of conservation practices they're interested in will tell us more about social receptivity of conservation in particular parts of the basin. So it's kind of like Pandora for agricultural conservation, where instead of selecting music that you like to hear and it creates your own radio station, this tool allows you to select conservation practices and allows you to interact with it, to tell it what you value most in the benefit of those conservation practices. And then that gives us some understanding of the social receptivity in that area. So again, these are some tools that exist and some tools that are being proposed for future development. And all of those tools can be pulled together to help us to integrate a view of where conservation actions should take place, what conservation actions have the opportunity for multi-sector, multifunctional benefit, and we have a forum to kind of pull that dialogue together as well. So I'm going to leave some flyers on a chair over here in case any of you are interested in the information about these tools. Or if you want access to those data layers, again, they're all online and freely accessible. So we'd love to have you use them. Thank you.